I would say it's very early on. But and then you start to look at the number of post-secondary educational programs, master's programs in innovation management, and they are exploding in AACSB, you know, accredited universities, which means that there is a supply and that there's a demand.
Yeah.
Now, our problem is that the demand waxes and wanes because we still don't have this ongoing commitment to more higher uncertainty innovation. And so that's what I'm working on now as far as my research.
Welcome to Innovation Talks. Join us weekly as we discuss with distinguished industry guests how to refine and improve corporate innovation and new product development. Hosted by Paul Heller, Sophion Chief Evangelist.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Hope you're having a great week out there. You know, you've heard me and a couple of my guests talk on this show about innovation. We've used the words occasionally that innovation is maturing. Well, I am really excited for our guest today. It is Gina O'Connor, and she is the professor of innovation management at Babson College. But she's more than just a professor. She's an author, a researcher, a consultant in fields of breakthrough innovation in large established companies, technological innovation, corporate entrepreneurship, strategic marketing, just kind of all aspects to it. And she has the view that innovation management, particularly for technological and breakthrough innovation, is emerging as a discipline and a profession in established companies. And that is just, boy, that is music to my heart. So I'm really glad. So Gina, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah. Where are you joining us from?
Well, right now I'm at my home in Albany, New York.
Albany, New York. So that's a little bit north of New York City. So Gina, tell us about your background. How did you get involved in innovation?
Well, I started my career as a professor. My PhD is actually in marketing and corporate strategy.
Mm-hmm.
My first role was as an assistant professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute.
Engineers.
Yeah, the engineers, you know, which I love because I love science and technology, but I couldn't understand it to explain it to anybody, but being around people who are discovering and inventing things and have that kind of curiosity has always been an interest for me. The people themselves and the cool stuff they come up with. So RPI had a tiny little business school, the Lally School of Management and Technology, it was called, and I joined there. We had a dean who wanted the faculty of the business school to really kind of build a common perspective and a common research program because we were so small. You know, how are we going to sort of make a name for ourselves? So we applied and received a very generous grant from the Sloan Foundation to study this topic of how large, mature companies can manage for the more breakthrough innovation. With the recognition, and this was long ago, this was in the late 90s, the recognition that U.S.-based industrial companies had really gotten quite good at sort of the new product development process.
Yeah.
You know, and we had studied it to death. There was an army of consultants going after it. The stage gate process was really had come into view, and we'd made pretty good improvements there. But as that occurred, the ability to really kind of think far forward and to work in the more ambiguous spaces to create the new had really declined in U.S. companies. So that was that proposal when the dean sent it around just completely, you know, captured my imagination. So I joined that team and we were about 10 academics, all from different parts of the business school and some from the School of Engineering. And we partnered with the Industrial Research Institute, which now has the same acronym, but has now changed its name to Innovation Research Interchange.
Okay.
They're a professional organization of R&D managers and directors. I know you're familiar with them. And they sponsored this. They really loved the idea of this research program.
Yeah.
So the research program started out as a study, a 5-year-long study where we would study projects that these guys identified to us as having the potential to be real game changers in their industry. And we, you know, identified a definition of, we were calling it radical innovation then, yeah, together with them. They volunteered. There were 10 companies that participated. They volunteered 12 projects in total. And we met with those teams over the course of time for 5 years. And we just learned an incredible amount about kind of the project manager's experience in navigating this uncertainty. And so we wrote our first book, which was called Radical Innovation, How Mature Firms Can Outsmart Upstarts. And Harvard Business Press published that book.
Yeah.
So we had learned a lot about the project manager's experience, but what we wanted to do at that point was, you know, we had kind of a theory of how companies could get better at this. And it was right at that time that Clayton Christensen's book had come out, and he was making the rounds saying, big companies really can't do this. You really need to put something off separate. And we were coming to a different conclusion based on some experiments that we had seen in two of the companies. So we started the second phase of the project. We went back to the IRI and we said, now what we'd like to do is study how companies who have a declared strategic intent to build this as an ongoing capability, not just one project, you know, how are they approaching it? And so, geez, many companies volunteered from the IRI, 11 of them kind of qualified into our sample. And then companies started call. At that time, I was the project leader on our side. I got a call from Intel saying they'd heard of the project and wanted to participate. So we opened up another like cohort that met every 6 months at RPI. So we were testing out what we were learning with this second cohort. So all told, it was about 21 companies that participated in different versions of that project. And that is what resulted in the grabbing lightning, where we started to identify this whole idea of a management system to support this, a portfolio of activities that's all around more breakthrough innovation.
Yeah.
And so that was really great. And I would say that bit of work was the most productive of our time, really productive. But what we noticed is that of all of those elements of a management system that supports or undergirds any initiative in a company, but particularly in this one, the new streams of growth, the single, and that was around, you know, that's all around what processes, what's your governance, how do you resource it, all of these elements. The single element that was probably the most challenging and the most surprising to us that kind of held companies back from persisting at this was talent management.
Wow. Okay.
Totally surprising.
Amazing. Yeah.
That we're not talking about the scientists, the R&D scientists. You know, if an R&D scientist has a hypothesis and goes to test the hypothesis and the hypothesis is not necessarily confirmed, that doesn't affect the guy's career. But if there's a new business creation person in there who is saying, I see opportunities for this, and that, and if that first shot out of the gate doesn't take hold, their career is penalized. That's what we had learned.
Interesting.
And so that's what caused us to undertake this third phase of the research on what resulted in the book Beyond the Champion.
Yeah.
Where we really tried to understand, you know, if R&D or your technology scouts or your corporate venture capital arm has spotted an opportunity that looks like it really could be a game changer, who do those people depend on to help get the work done to bring it to fruition? And so each person told us who they depended on, and we just kept following the trail all the way through to commercial reality and learned what those people do. We try to understand what their career path had been so far. What were their skills? How was their talent developed? And we ended up identifying a framework for roles that completely aligned with what we had identified in Grabbing Lightning about the organizational competencies that are necessary to make this happen at a portfolio level. And so that was how we ended up writing that third book of Beyond the Champion. So there you go. That's a long
I am so amazed. I had no idea the depth of that. That is an incredible story. You know, everybody jumps to process. They jump to maybe strategy. They jump to leadership, but talent and talent management. I really want to explore that. But just before we go into that, so now tell us about, you're now at Babson. Tell us about Babson. What you're doing there.
Well, RPI was wonderful. It was phenomenal. And, you know, we had this nice research team and all of that kind of thing. But a number of my colleagues had actually migrated over to Babson. And when the third book was coming out, Babson has this amazing executive education division and RPI did not. And I had begun working, we had developed a consultancy after the first book came out. And I was continuing to work with the woman who ran it, who we met in the course of our research, by the way. She ran the New Ventures division at Nortel Networks. Mm. And so that was a wonderful experience there because we got to test out what we were learning, you know, in companies who wanted to build the capabilities. And she completely respected the work. And I was right in there in the beginnings of most of these engagements. And we were turning things into kind of workshops and mechanisms for guiding this activity. At Babson, they were completely into developing a new practice area in corporate innovation. And they basically asked me to come over and run that. And so the person who was the provost at Babson who recruited me was the principal investigator at RPI on the first phase of the research. Mm. And then the person who was the department chair for the entrepreneurship department, which I'm a member of, was my co-author on the Beyond the Champion book.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a lot of
it's all networking. Yeah. Good news is you've been able to continue research, right? Part of what you do there.
Yeah.
My
last number of years at RPI, I was the associate dean for the business school. So the research, we finished and wrote the book, but a lot of the other ongoing research had kind of dropped off. I mean, when you're an administrator, it's really hard to do all of that. Plus, for a number of years, I was running our entrepreneurship center there as well, all at the same time. So those were some tough years. So this was really a nice thing to jump over to Babs. My husband and I have three kids. They were grown and gone. And so that freed me up to be able to travel more and that kind of thing. So I've been at Babson now for 5 years. That practice area is established. We have started to develop more courses for the MBA program, you know, in the college around this material. And so it's been it was a great move.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's just get into this innovation as a discipline and talent management. What were the signals that have caused you to say, you know, it is maturing and companies are treating it as a discipline like they weren't before. Tell us what you're seeing and how that's evolving and maybe where we are on the journey.
Well, we're not far enough along. I'll tell you that much. But okay. I did just have together with a co-author, Peter Robbins, University College Dublin, we published a paper in Journal of Product Innovation Management that kind of looks at this. Innovation as a there's a number of tests of a profession.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Okay. And so there's two kinds of professions. There's a collegiate profession, which is kind of like medical doctors and lawyers where you have to be certified and ongoing tests. And it's from the other professionals themselves that maintain those certifications. And there's a lot of standards and rules. We're not that. Even though there is now an ISO standard or ISO, what do they call it? Guidance.
56,000. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I know my former consulting partner is very active in designing and that, but there's not really there will be certifications, but it's more around all types of innovation practice as opposed to breakthrough or now what we're calling strategic innovation.
Okay.
Because there's so much ambiguity and uncertainty in this world that it's not going to be these rigid processes, right? Just as I mentioned, the whole idea is it has to become kind of a function in a company. And so what Peter and I were able to show is it does meet the tests of what we call a corporate profession.
Okay.
And what that means is that companies are coming to understand that you need to have this in place as its own identified group or function. And while the companies have not yet come to a common understanding of what we're looking for, they're right. at least recognizing this. And so we talk about, we see the growth in the number of sort of professional associations that focus on innovation management, huge growth in those and in the numbers of members of those. We see the growth in the number of jobs that are being posted on, for example, on LinkedIn or mm-hmm. Indeed, you know, we did those sorts of things. We interviewed HR professionals, a couple of HR professionals, who are beginning to see some movement in that direction.
Right.
And so I would say it's very early on, and then you start to look at the number of post-secondary educational programs, master's programs in innovation management, and they are exploding in AACSB, you know, accredited universities, which means that there is a supply and that there's a demand.
Yeah.
Now, our problem is that the demand waxes and wanes because we still don't have this ongoing commitment to more higher uncertainty innovation, right? Yeah. And so that's what I'm working on now as far as my research.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one because when times get tough for companies, they tend to lean back on their core innovation, right? And they not a survival. It's a short-term strategy, right? And we were talking with a guest last year about different types of portfolios. You have your strategic portfolio, you have your cash. He got the quote from some CEO at a big company in Germany who was speaking about portfolios as marathon portfolios and sprint portfolios. I thought that was such a great analogy, right? Marathon portfolio is where this strategic innovation is. And you've just got to continue to balance that. And then all of a sudden, but sometimes you got to go back and do the sprint, right? And it's an interesting concept to layer on top of those ideas you were just talking about. For those of you who can access events in Australia, Jared Ryan is facilitating his next Idea to Launch Innovation Masterclass at the Melbourne Business School on the 30th of April and the 1st of May, 2024. For more information and to sign up, head to our events page at sofion.com/about/events or go to the Sofion website and search for masterclass. So now let's talk about talent, right? So yeah, great. I'm glad to hear that there's now accredited institutions building programs around here, but really would love your thoughts to go and say that talent management is so critically important. Let's talk about that.
So what we were finding in the second phase of our study, and the one that resulted in the Grabbing Lightning book, and I know you're aware, and many of your listeners may be aware, that we identified that, you know, breakthrough innovation is not just this one amorphous capability. It really broke down into a discovery capability, which is all around opportunity finding and opportunity elaborating and articulating opportunities in ways that are really compelling. And we had to say all three of those because some people are terrible at the articulation part.
True. That's true.
You're still associated with all of those. But as an organizational competency, so discovery has processes in it, but it also has its own metrics. It also has its own skill sets. It also needs its own governance. All of these elements of this management system I'm talking about, you know, need to align with the objective of developing your strategic ambitions, what we've now called domains of innovation intent, and how you start working in those areas. So that's discovery. The second organizational competency is incubation. So after you've kind of populated the opportunity landscape in a big domain of innovation intent, in a big problem area that's future forward, that's not a fad. Now, how do you start getting after each of those opportunities and start to test and experiment? And there, what we learned in the first phase of our research, where we looked at the project manager's experience, is that when people test an experiment, they think about experimenting in technology arenas and in market uncertainty arenas.
Yeah, that's a classic. The classic, yeah.
Right.
I just can almost visualize the charts. Yep.
Right. But what we learned as far as project managers' actual experiences is that, yeah, those are definitely two dimensions or categories of uncertainty that are important to experiment. But there's two others. The first of those is resource uncertainty. And funding is one part of it. But the more important part is the competencies that are needed to bring to bear on this problem that you're looking at. And a lot of times you're working in a new category and, you know, your R&D group is all life sciences people, but what you really need are physicists right now, or you don't have manufacturing capabilities for this kind of opportunity space.
Right.
Right. So how you access those in a really agile way is important. And I think many other methods and tools deal with the resource uncertainty, but the one that was probably the most enlightening to us was organizational uncertainty.
Wow.
So there's four categories of uncertainty: T, technology; M, market; R, resource; and O, organizational, which many companies now call those the tomorrow uncertainty. So organizational uncertainty is, you know, as you're looking at a really interesting potential breakthrough opportunity space, a lot of different degrees of freedom emerge on business model, on which technological solution, on it's not just one product, it's a whole product family, right? It's a whole emergent business. Where should that live in your company? And it turns out, you know,
yeah,
it's a big problem because it doesn't necessarily fit in any division. It certainly usually does not work in the same business model arrangement. And it's those kinds of issues that prompt the organizational resistance that submarine these projects every time.
Wow.
And so, you know, you can call it politics, but really, you know, if we started to think about it as uncertainties and we started to heighten it and manage those uncertainties the way we do the rest, we would dispense with a lot of the politicking and actually have honest, open conversations. Same with, for example, when a team goes to get a project approved, we think we have this cool opportunity. We'd like X dollars to approve this. And they say, well, what's the return on investment? And they're like, well, we don't know.
Right.
And so then you're like, well, you can't get out of gate zero until you come up with a return on investment. So they make one up. I mean, we've seen it every time, right? So they make stuff up. We would much rather be able to have honest conversations and recognize you have all this uncertainty happening and operate within that. So there's a lot of other kinds of things around organizational uncertainty that we saw. You know, a business unit leader will sign up to say, yeah, I want to commit to that. If you can make this happen, I'll take it. And then that guy changes over. He's moved on and the next guy's in and that person doesn't want it.
Yeah.
So all the transition management issues and also the fact, you know, and then we end up blaming business unit or divisional leaders. But really, you know, they have certain deliverables that they're required to send back, the actual margins. And so it can't be a blame game. It's got to be an allocation of who's supposed to be doing what. And depending on what you do, that's how you get measured. So that's why we have discovery and incubation. And we actually then called out this third organizational competency called acceleration, which is the scaling of the emergent business. And typically, what we would see is projects go through this discovery and a half-baked approach to incubation, toss it over to the business unit, and the business unit would starve it for resources.
Ah, yeah.
It happens all the time.
Uh-huh. It's a classic, classic approach. Yeah. I can even relate to it. Yeah.
They take the first application or use case because it fit with their plan. They'd commercialize it and then all the rest of the opportunity space would be just left.
Yeah.
and it's completely under leveraged. And then leadership goes to the innovation squad, you know, strategic innovation team. So what have you done for me lately? You basically gave us one product over here that they should have come up with on their own. And then leadership just shuts it down.
Yeah.
So we need discovery, we need incubation, and we need acceleration. And not only that, we need people, as opposed to thinking of it as a pipeline of projects, we think of them as portfolios. Each domain of innovation intent, each large strategic ambition area has a portfolio of opportunities, right?
Right.
So you need people operating at the project or opportunity level. You need a domain leader, and then you need a portfolio leader across. That is what became our framework for these roles.
Yeah.
Okay. So discovery has a opportunity people. It has domain leaders and it has a portfolio leader. Same with incubation. And then in acceleration, your first level is really your leadership team of the emerging business, like the head of marketing, the head of operations, et cetera. And the second level is the general manager of that emerging business. So it's kind of a 3x3 grid. Yep. And on the top, you've got an innovation council that's run by the chief innovation officer. And then what we call an orchestrator, who's, this is going to sound weird, like the COO of the whole strategic innovation function.
Right.
Overseeing the, you know, is everything working? Is our churn rate and discovery meeting the objectives for our churn rate? Have I got the right, are we got the right people on the, those incubation opportunities right now? You know, there's, it's like internal auditing of the strategic innovation function. Yeah. And we have met these people in our research and our trail. That's how we identify these roles. Like we've met certain people.
Yeah, this is fascinating to me. So you now took that 3x3 grid and you started to articulate metrics, like you used the churn metric. So there are measurements in there. There are, that's fascinating.
Well, there's, if you can start to think about how you want to measure the productivity of the strategic innovation function itself, you know, there's, well, what are we trying to do in the first 3 years as we stand it up? And then what are our longer term, you know, outputs. So as one client company that I've worked with over the last year or so talks about it, what are our inputs? What are our outputs, like the churn and the number of ideas and the, all that stuff? And then what are the outcomes? And nobody measures the outcomes. And so So that discipline, then, if you can start to think about an innovation scorecard, which we talk about it at the portfolio level, and the domain, each domain.
Yeah.
You know, so you're looking at that. You can start to translate now. What are we looking for in our discovery opportunity generator people? What are they supposed to be doing?
Right. Exactly.
In order to make sure we have a rich opportunity landscape in this domain.
Yeah.
That's it. That's what they're supposed to do. We're not supposed to measure them on other stuff. And that's been the problem. Right.
Right.
We're measuring everybody using the same metrics that you would be measured if you're a product manager in a business unit.
Yeah.
And that's not the right things.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing that's going through my mind then, when you use those, you know, opportunity leader, domain leader, portfolio leader, I'm thinking, how do people know even how to do those jobs? Right.
Well, so beyond the champion, for each of those roles, we describe what are the, what's the role and responsibility? What are the tasks and activities that those people spend their time on? And then how, what are the metrics for evaluating their activity?
Yeah.
You know, their progress. Then we look at how would you select these people? What are, and we, so from the people that we've interviewed, what are their kind of personal characteristics?
Yeah.
What are their skills and experience, critical experiences that they've had so far, you know, in their career? And so that the book is, it's not written in terms of job descriptions. We haven't, you know, we didn't like get that, but companies have used that. And I have now since then continued to work on kind of developing a sort of assessment tools, first for selection and self-assessment tools, and then how you would build a group to make sure you've got coverage across all of the roles, and then also kind of a capability metrics matrix for each of the roles so that if you're my supervisor, Paul, and I'm coming to you and I'm a domain leader in incubation and I'm really building an emerging business, how do we have the conversation about right. my performance, right? And so it has to fit the same way that HR people evaluate everybody else. And so we have to build those tools. And that's, I've been, you know, working on that. And there is one company that's beginning to institute some of these roles in their HR system. Mm. That's what we need.
Yeah.
Because these people volunteer into these jobs. Everybody knows that they're great at doing it, but when they move on, nope, there's no backfilling of the role.
That's
it. It's not a role, you know?
Yeah. And when you're in one of those boxes, I'm back to that grid because it's so good in my mind, how you talk to people in the other boxes, you know, how do you communicate to them? Because they're coming from a different perspective. They're motivational, the reward system, everything is a bit different, depending probably how far away your box is from theirs. So I think it's also very helpful to help people learn about each other. And I'm just going to go back to a podcast I did with Dan Adams, who you know recently, and he was talking about the leadership characteristics, decorator.
Yeah, he's got
right?
his trips.
It was fun. It was fun to see, but it was the same idea of, you know, how do you talk to people?
Yeah. Now, one thing I'll tell you, which was another motivation for that third phase of our study, is that many of the people that we encountered in our research, and I have encountered since, had been promised that if, you know, so you've got this really cool idea. If you can really build it, you'll be the general manager of that business.
Okay.
And that's how you're going to, your career path into general management and to highly influential positions is predicated on the success of that thing. Not one person made it.
Wow.
Not one.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, why would they? In right. many cases, they're not interested in running
no,
the business.
That's right.
I mean, why would you
wrong
take
motivator.
Exactly. And so, but they wanted to have a position of influence in the company.
Yeah.
And so the other thing we've done in Beyond the Champion and worked with organizations on is how do you actually generate a career path for people who are very frustrated that they've been doing the same thing for X number of years and can't be recognized for
right.
it.
Yeah.
And so we've got, you know, a chapter or two in there that makes recommendations around career
right.
pathing and rewards and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah. It is so, so important. I remember being in software my entire life and running a software development shop at times. And we had some really talented software people, but the only path to have corporate influence was management, right?
Yeah.
And we had to develop the other pathways, which were the non-management pathways for these people to get the what they wanted in their career and the respect that they wanted and the influence that they wanted to give and the impact they wanted to make. So that it was kind of like these two paths. And I think I could really relate to this.
Yeah, we have a paper, a working paper called The Third Career Path, you know, because, you know, that in R&D, there's the management path
right.
and then there's kind of the R&D fellows.
Yeah.
But there's another person that needs to be in there, and that's the new business creation person.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. So, Gina, when you think about turnover now that's happening in so many companies, there's people, you know, coming and going and people switching companies or companies letting people go. It seems to be a lot of turnover. I thought it was going to decline a little bit after COVID, but now we see tech companies in particular
yeah.
still downsizing and shrinking. So when I think about talent, I think about talent management, and I think about that intersection of that. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I mean, I think that it'll settle out a little bit, like many companies bloated up, in particular
right.
the tech companies. And so that part will settle. But it's true that how many years ago, Paul, you know, it used to be that we taught our students that, well, we were told to teach our students that the loyalty between employees and companies no longer exists. And so always be looking for your next job. Well, that in some ways, it's good. It refreshes the organization, but in many ways, it's not good.
Right.
And I'll tell you that in one of the studies we've done, we found that the single most highly correlated management, we looked at a variety of management practices and correlated them with breakthrough innovation outcomes. The single highest correlate was the strength of internal informal networks.
Yeah, I can believe that.
Yeah. And so, you know, first of all, it casts some dispersion on the whole thing around open innovation, which it's not, I mean, there needs to be a combination. But the other thing, because there's other data that we have now, anyway, that's a separate thing that about the strength and the power of like the internal workings of the company.
Yeah.
But it is a sad thing. And so that's one of the reasons why we're out there doing a lot of talking about these research findings that are coming up over and over again. And so it's not just the informal networks, but it's also, is there a group that's identified as responsible for creating the future for the company? And how do you set it up so there's not an us versus them mentality from your organizational culture?
Yes, correct.
And so it bleeds into a lot of issues. But the one on actually more on talent management is we did a study, we did a little survey about turnover and, you know, people in these innovation roles. And we found, you know, they cycle out of innovation and back in because they were losing credibility. And in order to get a promotion, they had to be in a business unit for a while and all this kind of stuff. So their turnover rates were about the same as in any other part of the company.
Okay.
But what we did find is that more would leave the company than would cycle back in to other parts of the organization. And when they left the company, the next job they took was in an innovation role in another company. Mm. So when I show that to executives, they cringe because everybody says, you know, this is rare talent. And yet we're like sending them away.
Yes, that is exactly. I've had the same experience and it's a horrible experience when you didn't even realize that you weren't giving that person what they needed, the opportunity. When you're dying in this part of your business over here, there's a perfect fit and you just, it's not in front of your eyes. You can't see it. You don't make it happen. That is a huge leadership failure that many companies stumble on for sure. Yeah.
So I'm really of the belief, you know, you asked, you know, where are we in this innovation profession? And so many people like myself and like you, people who work with companies on their innovation capabilities, we are coming to the same conclusion. Reading the graph, you know, even Henry Chesper, Open Innovation, obviously Mike Tushman and group at Harvard and our team, it's all around this ambidexterity thing.
Yeah.
And structural ambidexterity, that you've got a group that's focused on the new stream and a group that's the biggest group is focused on the mainstream and the core business.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be that expensive. I think leaders have like thrown huge money at it and they expect massive returns immediately. Yep. But it's got to be steady and persistent. And this will blow people's minds, but we have to do continuous improvement of our strategic innovation function. And you can only do it. You can only build organizational expertise by sticking with it and keeping at it. And we are coming to very clear conclusions about what works and what doesn't work.
I know.
So
that
I think it's the next level of management sophistication in our companies.
Yeah. And if you could do that is innovation maturing without a doubt. Now you're getting discipline around it. It's, you know, a lot of people have been talking about it, but you just articulated very well a whole bunch of things that underpin that. Now, when I go around and talk about innovation maturing, I've got some more, oof behind it. Yeah. This was great, Gina. Well, it's a lot of fun. What's on your research agenda in the future? Or are you allowed to kind of talk about it yet?
Well, let's see. I have a lot of papers going on right now. I've got a paper where I'm trying to write about what should be in organizations. What are all the business models, all the models that companies have tried to do organizational renewal through innovation and what works and what doesn't? So intrapreneuring.
Right.
Give everybody 15%, whatever. Offsite incubators and accelerators. corporate venture capital funds, these kind of appendage models, innovation programs like hackathons, what of these are working and under what circumstance? And in also built into that paper is a lot of thinking around how you handle general purpose technologies like AI being the main one now versus more special purpose technologies. And so that's a little bit of probably a complication, but that, you know, I just want to get it out there.
Yeah.
Around that. We worked with W.L. Gore on, so I've got a set of 8 principles for strategic innovation and trying to get that written out. Nice. And W.L. Gore has been a fascinating case study because while I did work with them a little bit, but it's over the course of their time and their existence, how they approached each of those principles. So people say, you know, when I go and give like talks with to leaders and they fill out the little quiz on where do they stand on these 8 principles, they say, you know, how does this work in our industry versus another industry? And the fascinating thing is the principles seem to be pretty universal, but how they play out in the context of the industry dynamics, is it a software-based industry? Is it heavy, you know, capital, that kind of thing? And so we're turning that now into a teaching case with W.L. Gore.
Wow.
I just had a paper published in Sloan Management Review on the effect of discovery and incubation on outcomes with colleagues at MIT who had a data set that we just applied the concepts and they ran the analysis. So that was pretty cool. I'm working a lot now on return on investment for strategic innovation. And I'll be doing a lot of talks over the spring around that. I just had a paper out on a lot digging more into uncertainty management, you know, those 4 dimensions of uncertainty.
Yep.
It turns out they're very intertwined. So organizational uncertainty and market uncertainty are very, you don't know how to go after one because the other's not stable yet.
Yeah.
So what's the product manager to do?
Right. And
so we have a paper that reports on that on a number of different case studies. So there's probably 8 or 9, 10 papers in the works. And now I've also got a whole research stream going on ethical issues associated with progressing and commercializing emerging or advanced technologies. Yeah.
Yeah. You've got a lot going on. And, you know, any one of those papers is going to be exciting to read. I know there's a whole bunch of people waiting in line for the ROI on strategic innovation. Gee whiz. That's going to have a big impact for people. So this is fascinating. I can't thank you enough, Gene. I had no idea this conversation would go where it went, but it was incredibly valuable. And I really appreciate you taking your time to share what you've been doing. If people want to follow you and track what you're doing and engage, what's the best way?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn and yep. They can find me at Babson, G. O'Connor at babson.edu.
We'll make sure we put the link. We'll make sure we put the LinkedIn reference in there for sure, that so people can find you and follow you. A lot of people like to follow people on LinkedIn. Any last minute comments, Gina, that before we kind of wrap up today's chat?
Well, I mean, I am very busy trying to educate people who are early to mid-career and tell them all the time, you'll be the first, you know, generation that's been really exposed to a number of these kinds of topics so that when you move into positions of influence and leadership, you'll understand about the new stream versus the mainstream and how you build those and run them together in parallel. I really do think that, you know, years ago we had the purchasing department and that has become the whole supply chain management function of the company.
Yeah.
And now we used to have a new product development process, but I think the whole innovation, strategic innovation function will become, you know, the next level of sophistication in our companies today.
Yeah.
It's not that expensive. Everybody says it's all because of short-termism, but if you keep at the portfolio, you've got one gap of about 5 years before stuff comes. And you just have to keep feeding it bit by bit, and then you won't ever have a gap again.
Yeah.
So I don't know. This is not rocket science. I
think well, and I'm so excited at the future generation of business professionals and participants and leaders and innovation workers and all that have somebody like you to guide them and help them find their way. That's just really got to be incredibly rewarding for you on that aspect for sure. Well, Gina, again, thanks for joining us. And we'll keep in touch.
All right. Thank you, Paul.
I hope you all enjoyed that. That is an incredible discussion. And do check out the links in the show notes for more information. And think, check out those books. There's incredible information in there that Gina mentioned. And reach out to her, especially through LinkedIn. Follow what she's doing. I think you'll find it very valuable. Take care, everybody. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week. Bye for now.
Thanks for joining us this week for Innovation Talks with Paul Heller. If you enjoyed the show, please like and subscribe on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, or wherever you listen to podcasts. For additional information on today's topic, check out sopheon.com, S-O-P-H-E-O-N.com, where you will find plenty of innovation-centric content and corporate best practices. If you'd like to discuss anything with Paul or would like to get in touch with the show, email us at talks@sopheon.com.